The panel discussion of the Media Summit, of course, is always the highlight of the day-long Lewis B. O'Donnell Media Summit. It is surely the summit's biggest live audience ever that we have here today. But that is only because we've provided a larger venue and more seats for this 10th edition. The Media Summit is always a top draw because it promises a stellar gathering and a thought-provoking afternoon. Several of our visiting media professionals have been meeting with students and speaking in classes all day. Now they will bring their heads together and address the questions that they confront daily in their individual lives of writing articles, interviewing newsmakers, and running a media business. These are some of the most talented and accomplished people working on the front lines of the industry today. They can tell you how the digital revolution has been a blessing for them, or perhaps how it has been a curse, how they chase us, the fickle readers, the viewers, from one platform to another. We were talking about that a little bit at lunch. And how, when they're lucky, they ace multiple platforms and reach multiple audiences and do it all at the same time. After all, I no longer need a newspaper to read Connie Schultz. I don't need a book or magazine to read Ken Auletta. I don't need a TV to watch Al Roker or Charlie Rose. I've got a phone, and I can't even count the number of devices that I have. They're my tools. I think of them as tools of the trade, but they just might be tools of life. I can address these premier content creators and their followers in a public forum via Twitter or any of a growing number of outlets the digital revolution has given us. The public fora and the voices in them have become a cacophony of information and certainly of points of view. I'm hoping our guests today give us some advice about how to navigate this vibrant and chaotic sea of voices.
Thank you. Now that you're a doctor, Charlie, even though you don't have tenure, let me start with you. You've been quoted
Dr. Rose.
I'm sorry. Dr. Rose, you've been quoted as saying that the golden age of television is upon us.
Indeed.
Explain.
Two ways. First, the fact that we are seeing now some of the best drama we have seen ever, I think. Secondly, it has enabled talented people to have access to television. For a long time, some of our best creators of comedy and drama weren't working in television. They were working in film, and now they're all beating their way to television because they can tell stories longer and better, and they have the resources to tell them well. That's number one. Number two, for those of us who are in the information business, we have more tools at our disposal than we've ever had before, more information at our disposal than we've ever had before, and we have more means to distribute that information. That's not all good, and that enables some people to have access that, based on what they say, is not necessarily productive and does not contribute to the conversation. But it is overwhelmed, I think, on balance by our access. Just think about it. You know, you can take a device like I have here, you know, and you can pretty much go and go through Google Maps and see anywhere in the world. You can have access to all the great art in the world. You can have access to all the libraries in the world. You can have a conversation with people you never imagined having a conversation with. That ought to enable you, for those of us in the information business, to do it better. As I said, it gives access to people who do not mean well and who have a nasty spirit, but on balance, that's healthy.
You know, Charlie has really introduced the subject of this panel, which is, and the topic is the digital revolution a blessing or a curse, or both? So let me begin with a jump ball to the entire panel, starting with you, Connie. Blessing, curse, both?
I would say it started out, in my view, as a curse, which got me to the place where it feels like a blessing. Because I was dealing with online comments, the vitriol of anonymity on a news website, and I was so discouraged by what was happening there. First of all, it was not a place I wanted to wade into in the comments, and I think when we talk about digital media, one of the advantages of it is it gives us a chance to directly engage with readers, in my case, readers. And I really don't understand any journalist today not wanting to do that. Because if you still love reporting, which I do, there's so much to learn from interacting with the people you're trying to reach. I was so frustrated, though, also because so many people, I would go give speeches, and so many in the audience would ask, why do they let that stuff go online? I don't want to read stories. I don't want to share them because I don't want people to see the comments. So I started an experiment on Facebook. Some of you I know are on there with me. I've been hearing from some of you. And I made it a public page. It's not a fan page. It started out as a personal page. And my goal was to see, could we have spirited discussions with civility? Could we disagree? Could we duke it out? And it's turned into, I mean, I have 130,000 followers. I have no idea why. I think a fourth of them are from Egypt. But I have a lot of journalists on there as well, and they tell me they often go there for sourcing. When I throw out a question, for example, and Ohio is a battleground state, as you know, politically, always. So there's a lot going on with that. But what I've also come to love about using social media, I am a big fan of Facebook for this reason, I can drive traffic to other journalists' work, including The New Yorker, which has made itself so much more available online now. So if I see something I like, and I want to host a discussion, but I also want more people to read it because it's traditional journalism, the best of traditional journalism, I will drive traffic to it. So for me, it's become a way also to merge my personal and my public lives, because I do have the, to some confounding, relationship of being married to a United States senator and also being a syndicated columnist. And in this way, I can merge those worlds and own the narrative of my own life. And it helps me correct misperceptions very quickly.
But as the only print journalist on this panel, I mean, you see, we have 40% fewer print journalists today than, say, 10 years ago. You didn't mention that negative of dying newspapers. Do you
Right, because
worry
I feel like
that?
We're actually at the funeral. And so I'm assuming we're all acknowledging that. It is a challenging time. I am very lucky to still make a living as a print journalist, and I know that. I also know that I now cobble together various contracts and ways to do it, and so I'm writing for Parade, and I'm writing for Politico, and I did a thing for ESPN Magazine recently because they found me. But here's what I don't want you to take from that. I don't want you to be discouraged from pursuing traditional journalism, because your generation brings the skill set that too many of my generation has been resisting. For you, it's like your primary language. For us, it was a foreign language. And that has so informed the work and also the decline of our profession, because if we had been listening to some of our younger staffers sooner, we would have been figuring out the web much sooner, and we would not have been giving content away for free. So we did that. You can't bring that, you really can't repackage that one. So the challenge now is, how do we make the web a place that advertisers want to be visiting, that they want to help fund? That's why I think moderating your comments, investing in that is worth it, because it creates a different environment for that. But I think we need your skills terribly. As I've said repeatedly today, I love new media, but I love traditional journalism even more. And it is such a winning combination when you apply the values of traditional journalism, the boundaries and the ethics of that, and combine it with new media and the ways that you can close the distance so quickly with readers. Those days of, you know, from the mountaintop preaching, and we would tell you what you should care about, no longer exist. And the more willing we are to engage with the people we're trying to attract to our work, I think the more successful we're going to be.
Al, how has the digital revolution affected what you do so well on today's show?
Well, I think it's an addendum. It's another channel, if you will, to get to people, because look, the fact of the matter is, if somebody wants a weather forecast, they can go to an app on their phone. They don't really need to wait to either watch the Weather Channel or what we do on the Today Show. But at the end of the day, I think we've tried to stop thinking of there's TV and then there's the mobile. It's a screen. It's a different way of watching. And whatever that is, we need to engage those people. And so what we do on the Today Show is one thing. And I think at the end of the day, people still watch television for people. I mean, the one great thing about morning television, and I think Charlie would agree with this, is that it's almost time shift proof. You know, it's not one of those things that you're going to DVR. You're going to watch
it. You said that today,
because you need it to, when you, people are still getting up in the morning and they want to see what's happening, and you know, whether it's the hard news of the day or information, they're going to get that. And so we provide that, but then on our digital space, we provide the other stuff. We have our Orange Room, or Good Morning America has the Social Square, things like that. We can engage at that level of it, but I believe people watch TV for people. People want to get the question that Charlie Rose is going to ask that newsmaker. They can, because it gives some context as opposed to just finding it online.
I just to add to what Al just said, I mean, the morning television begins the conversation for the day. It is the first chance that most people have as they're getting up to see what's happened in the 24 hours or in the 8 hours since they went to bed. And they get up and in morning television is a kind of picture. They can do online at the same time or go from one to the other, but I think that they get up and they put the television screen on at the breakfast table, and it's their introduction. And it starts the day and puts them on a road in which they will consult, and through their mobile device primarily, for the rest of the day.
And
but it kickstarts both the appetite and the menu.
So Charlie and I have the distinction of most people watch our shows while they're in the bathroom.
Yes, exactly.
Or in the kitchen.
Or in the kitchen, right.
So in that fundamental sense...
After I put them to bed at evening.
In that fundamental sense, it hasn't changed.
No.
The digital world. Dennis, in the television station business, how has it changed your life?
Well, I think it's given us, answer to your original question. Yeah, I think it's a positive thing. I think it's positive in that the broadcast television, as I've always seen it, has been kind of a linear medium, that you watched it in some kind of sequential order. What the digital age has given us is given us the ability that to stay in contact with our viewers all day long. They don't have to wait for the 6 o'clock news to find out what the weather is. We're available online now all day long. And we can take the content of our stories, the stories that our reporters report on during the broadcast news period, during the 20 or so minutes that they get out of a half hour of local news, a lot of commercials, I know. But we could take that content and now put it on the web, and a lot of times we have much more video, many more interviews. We may have only shown a snippet of that interview, you know, with Senator Brown. But online, we can show the entire interview. I mean, it's given us a richness, I think that's given us a bigger, broader part of the whole conversation.
How has it changed what your journalists do, those local television journalists, how they actually report? How is it different because of the digital revolution?
I think that still the reporting is I think it's remarkably similar. But now we have in the newsroom people that can take that content and take those scripts, and you know, very often now we'll take the entire script and put it in print. So if you don't want to watch the video, you could read the story. But I think it's given our reporters a lot more freedom, a lot more elbow room to try to tell a more complete story.
So the four of you have suggested the more optimistic, sunny side of the digital revolution. Let's talk about the dark clouds. What concerns you most about how the digital revolution is affecting, say, journalism?
I'm very concerned about how it's driving too many news organizations to push their reporters to post first, correct later. I'm very concerned that we're calling corrections updates when they are indeed corrections. I think it's not as important to be first as it is the first to be right. And I'm very concerned that most reporters I know reject this out of hand, but feel pressured to do it because of editors who are not in the business of reporting anymore, if they ever were. There's always been the tension between reporters and their editors, but I am watching it play it's writ large in Cleveland right now, what's happened with the Plain Dealer, and they've gone to only several days delivery. They are clearly trying to gut the union there, taking more and more jobs out of the guild. And if you're not protected by the guild, I speak as a columnist, many times I was getting called, I always called it being called into the principal's office before the Pulitzer, because they didn't like the reader anger that some of my stuff was generating. But my guild membership made it clear always that they could take away my column, but they couldn't take away my job. And I can't overstate for you how much that can embolden a columnist, an opinion writer. So I'm very concerned about this up-fast misinformation like crazy. And I'm also, I want to address the women in the room, because I hear this so often, particularly from young women, who can be very intimidated by the gender-focused hate that can come online. I've been a columnist for 12 years. My home address is public. I get a lot of hate mail, and I'm still standing. And I want us to make sure we keep a sense of balance about this. There is a lot of misogyny out there, but as I said on Steve Kornacki's show recently on MSNBC, the minute they go after my age, my weight, or my gender, I win, because they had no argument of substance to counter me.
Charlie, let me rephrase the question to you. One of the reasons you're celebrated is because you allow people on your evening show, Charlie Rose, to finish a sentence and, in fact, speak in paradise, which is very unusual in today's world. What are you, in the television realm, what are you worried about going forward?
Well, I both worry and celebrate the fact that I'm in a minority, because I'm happy with a monopoly, by the way. And on that circumstance, I'm not an anti-monopolist. What I worry about most is a part of what Connie said. It is fast moving now, and I always thought a good editor was a good thing. If you can self-edit, good, but I suspect that even at the New Yorker, they occasionally might edit a sentence or a line of your piece. And I think that's a good thing. It's good for me.
Yeah, we don't have unions. If I had a union, I'd protest. Yeah.
It's a good thing, and I think that function is not there as it is. And especially, we do live television. It's pretty hard for them to edit that. For someone whose curiosity was whetted by, I lived in the country in eastern North Carolina, and I got books from a bookmobile. The idea of learning was stimulated for me by that bookmobile, and so the magic of being able to do that in such an economical way today is incredible to me. I worried that at certain aspects that sensationalist triumphs quality, because I believe that what I do is quality, but I'm not one who worries as long as it doesn't stamp out quality. And I think there's, in journalism today, as good a reporting as we have ever had. I pick up great newspapers, and I see great broadcasts. I was just at the Emmy Awards, and I said this, I don't know how we were there, and I watched at all of the content that was being presented that was up for awards, and it was remarkable how much good work there's being done. You see this all the time. So I'm less worried and more encouraging of people to come to journalism today and find their place and dream their dreams, because I think you can. I also at the same time know, and I don't know what we do, that there are a hell of a lot of very good journalists who I have known, and because of whatever reason, Connie knows the same thing, can't get a job today. And that's the saddest part of it, And I've been able to survive, because I believe in quality, and because I have some power over my own survival.
Al, if you went back 15, 20 years and looked at old clips of the Today Show, you would see that first hour would be full of serious, long interviews. You would go to Russia when Jeff Zucker was executive producer, and you would do extraordinary interviews, Brian Kumbel doing them. And you watch today, and it's snippets, much less hard news. And when you ask the executive or the executives why, they will say there's so much choices that people have that we just have to shout a little louder mm-hmm. and get more people in our tent because they're fleeing the tent. Is that a cause for worry on your part?
I think we have worked, and look, it's no secret that the CBS Morning News does a great job of that. And we have, on the show, if you watch, we have tried to actually extend that, the harder news, past the 7:30 half hour. But look, you're competing against a lot of other sources. And you know, you try to pick your places where you can do longer journalism and do harder journalism, but you've got to find that balance, and it's a constant, in a sense, dance to find that balance. And we try not to look too much at numbers because you know you don't want to say, well, we had some trending YouTube clip on and that did really well, so let's do more of those. So it really is finding the balance. But you talk about the dark side of the internet, and one of the things I've got a 12-year-old and a almost 16-year-old and an older daughter as well, but kids who are in school, and the thing that worries me about the internet, I keep telling my kids, just because it's on the web doesn't mean it's true. You know, there's a vetting process that doesn't seem to happen in newer media. That becomes it because it becomes repeated enough, it becomes a fact, and you know which would not necessarily happen with print journalism because you had fact checkers, you had editors, and you don't see that as much anymore.
Ken, let me turn this around. And since I do what you're now doing,
you're not allowed to do it, Charlie.
didn't take him long. Here we go.
I'm sitting in the center. And I'm a doctor.
very good. So am I.
Before I was.
I have eight of them, just to point it out.
Wow.
And my mother would not have approved of that comment. So that
I was going to say, it sounds like yours is bigger.
And see.
You actually write about this, and you think about this more than anybody up here does, I think. I mean, what is it that troubles you? We know all the upside. And then what troubles you beyond, you know, the bookstores being hurt and journalists not being able to find the kind of work they found before?
I worry about what it does to our brains. I worry that people raised on devices, which is geared to snacking, that somehow that affects their ability to read longer books, indulge in longer pieces, watch your show at night. I worry what it does in education. I worry about professors and teachers who are competing with the wow factor and that snacking factor, and students who are coming into a class with their devices and maybe tweeting or whatever while that professor is trying to figure out some way to capture their attention. And I worry medically, and I don't know the answer to this, but I know there's been a fair amount written about this. Medically, what it actually, does it attenuate our brains in some way? Those are questions I would.
The last one is certainly interesting to me.
So from in your world, in the television world, we're talking about the downside at this moment.
Sure.
We'll go back to the upside. But how has it affected the journalism that local stations, digital world, affected the journalism?
I think the journalism continues, and I think our anchors and reporters continue to try to get the news and deliver the news. I think what's happened, though, on a local basis, and really local news is the lifeblood of a local television station, is because we're competing against smartphones and tablets, we're losing eyeballs. We're literally losing eyeballs because we find that that communal family experience of watching the news is kind of disappearing from homes. And many people in this room, many of the young people in this room are interested in the news because that's your college major. But we find that that audience, particularly that lower level of the audience, that 18 to 24 quotient to 18 to 34 quotient, isn't embracing local news. And we're living on the older group. Living on the older audience.
And yet
is 60 Minutes, and so is the evening news.
That's not what the advertisers want, unfortunately.
The advertisers want the younger group. On the other hand, when you look at survey research, Pew surveys, et cetera, most people, including young people, get their news not from the internet, but by a small margin from television.
Right.
So that kind of challenges a little bit what you're saying.
Well, I think one of the things we look at is it's kind of there's an expression in radio called time spent listening. And to judge a good radio station, it's really not on the average quarter hour. It's the time spent listening. The longer you get them listening from morning drive to midday to afternoon drive, the more valuable you are. Because to an advertiser, boy, you can repeat that message and really deliver that message home. What we're finding out is, yes, we're getting the viewers, but the time spent viewing is shrunken. And particularly outside the news realm, in other forms of programming, particularly prime time, which for unfortunately very few programs are watched live anymore. Sports being born of news programs, of course, but even 60 Minutes. Yeah. Is a lot of people watch 60 Minutes tape delayed or on a DVR.
And when I grew up, it was appointment viewing.
Correct. And we're losing that. So the time spent viewing, even though that's the majority of what people are source of their news, but the time spent viewing is shrinking, particularly on the younger age.
But the other argument that people make, and particularly local reporters on television, is that what also is shrinking is the headcount. And so the number of journalists you have covering municipality, let's say, is much reduced than it was 10, 15 years ago. And that causes some... Fair to be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a fact of life. The newspaper, the advertising is not growing. Newspaper is not a growth field. Magazine, it's not a growth field. Radio, it's marginally growing. Broadcast television, it's marginally growing. The big growth is the web. It's growing double digit each year. And particularly we're seeing it with the national advertisers. Not so much the local advertisers. The local car dealer is always going to have a presence on the web because he knows that when people buy cars, you know, by reflex anymore, we go to the web. And the local real estate people are all over the web because we want to look at a house. We're going to go to the web. We get to see 100 houses in an afternoon. But what seems to be happening is we're losing, you know, that audience that we had before. And we're losing the ability to influence them as much. We still influence them, but not as much as we used to do.
You know, Connie, you mentioned before that this notion that I've lost my thought. You said if we had not given away for free information, digital world, if we had charged Google or put a paywall or a metered system around our online journalism, it might have had an impact, but you can't go back and revisit that now. But what you can visit now is what should newspapers be doing for the future to try and create more interest, more revenue to keep them alive?
Well, that's the big question, is it not? I mean, Parade Magazine just got sold. As you know, last month, as Steve Newhouse explained to me, they lost 12 million last year. And they have a high circulation rate, 45 million, so they were in newspapers all around the country, and they were bleeding money. And what concerns me is that we've got too many of the traditional journalists, the editors and publishers, who are not bringing in enough of the young blood to help in the problem solving. I really think, again, that's one of the reasons I come to a summit such as this. It's because I think our solution is in this audience. I think that you already know how you find news, how you process news, how you report news. I suspect you also have some ideas on how we could be monetizing that, that we aren't thinking about. And I hope sooner than later we start tapping into that. I mean, it's interesting to watch BuzzFeed, for example. BuzzFeed started out basically as a listicle service, right? And now BuzzFeed wants to be a serious news organization. And it's going through some growing pains as it's trying to figure out how to be taken seriously. They're doing some good reporting, but they still got this whole list thing going on that a lot
of... How about cats?
Yeah, for example. Right. And it's I've been intrigued by what they're trying to do, and they've been hiring some people, but I also know that it looks like they're basically hiring at the very junior level, things like copy editors and stuff. I'm a big fan of copy editors, for any of you who are copy editors out there. So right now it just feels a lot, that old cliche of throwing it at the wall, seeing what sticks, that's what it's feeling like too much right now. Am I correct? I think the Wall Street Journal is the only one but it has a niche market, right? And it had a paywall from the beginning, did it not? It did not ever give away for free.
So no. In fact, Murdoch, when he took over the journal, said he's going to drop the paywall because you get many more eyeballs, and they convinced him not to because... You know, it was making good
and
revenue.
He was actually one of the early ones who were prepared to put it up. I mean, he said, I'm going to challenge, I'm not giving this thing away.
And they make real money with the paywall, yeah. as do the others. The problem for newspapers becomes that does the income you generate from the digital edition with a paywall match the income you're losing
from
declining?
Irrefutably, no. And you're seeing, I remember a statistic, forgive me if I'm not exact on the timeline here. I think it was 5 years ago, AP released this study that showed that only half the states in the country had a single reporting journalist in Washington, D.C., for the entire state. It's got to be fewer than that now.
It is.
When you look at the complexities of Washington, and the dysfunction in Washington right now, and you think of how much more they're going to be able to get away with, not just in D.C., but at the state government level, at the local government level, because we don't have reporters who are keeping them accountable anymore. And at that point, I really get concerned about the state of our country.
But is that because of number or competence or something else?
Well, I look at what's happening in Cleveland, and they've taken all the jobs of veteran reporters, increasingly, not all, but increasingly, they just did three more, and they're moving them to young people who are not in the union, who they can pay a smidgen of what they paid before, and they're all of a sudden, they hurl them out there into the court system, into politics, and there is institutional memory that brings great value to reporting. By institutional memory, I mean people have been doing it for a long time. And look, I'm the first to argue we need more people of color and more women covering politics, because it really is beyond time. And I saw it firsthand when I took a leave of absence in 06 and watched my husband's Senate race in Ohio from the inside. And you kept, and nothing against middle-aged white men, I love you, but if that's all that's showing up to cover a very important statewide race, we've got some issues with what kind of questions get covered, yeah. What kind of perspective is brought to the coverage. So of course those are issues. But I'm very concerned with this practice of getting rid of your expensive veterans. And that's been the solution too often. Let's get rid of the high-priced staff and bring in the newbies who are really hungry, and you should be. But be mindful what they're offering you, and be mindful of what all they're going to be asking you to do for a fraction of what someone in my generation made at your age. When I started at the Plain Dealer in a guild position in 1993, the first minute, my first paycheck, I made more than my father ever did at the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company in maintenance. That's what it meant to be a guild reporter at a newspaper, and those days are virtually over.
One of the things we worry about, Ken, as you know from our late friend Peter Jennings, is a real concern about how much we're spending to cover foreign news. I mean, how many reporters are less on the foreign beat? And increasingly, the stories that are the most compelling are there, and most threatening, I suggest, ISIS and Ebola.
And yet, when I watch the CBS Evening News, actually CBS has made a reinvestment right. in international news coverage. And NBC has Richard Engel risking his life yeah. everywhere all over the world.
And, yeah.
So there are some...
No. But there ought to be more Richard Engels and more Clarissa Wards. And because they really are risking their life. I mean, they're sneaking across borders to go into Syria. And there's always the risk of being kidnapped and
but,
do
but
it out
if
of
you
and you see organizations
to cover the story.
You see organizations like Vice going in and, yeah. And really engaging with a younger yeah. audience, but still doing, in a sense, traditional journalism, mm-hmm. broadcast journalism, and, in a sense, digital print journalism. But yet, they seem to have this yeah. formula that...
Yeah. Let me also point out one thing that I think is true that today, and it is... what we're seeing now and is a number of people who are leaving print journalism, I think Bill Keller and Ezra Klein from the Washington Post, and they're going out to do digital things. And what they're creating is digital things that are now you to drill down. I mean, Ezra Klein is doing a lot of interesting things on healthcare, where if you want to go further, he really does have a place that you can go further. And Bill Keller's doing it, and as you know in your own area, what Mossberg and... Kara
Swisher.
Yeah. I mean, you can really get more and more. I mean, I find in my daily life, as busy as I am in what I do, I don't have enough time to consume all the media that I want to see. You know, it's my own limitation. You know, and you think about people who are not in media and how they, you know, how they find. I wonder if they have, you know, if they have enough time to consume all the media that they want to consume.
But to go back to the point that Connie was making about covering city halls and state governments and investigative reporting. There is no question that there's much less of that today, and not just in Washington, but,
you know,
and a reason for that, and I wish you'd like to throw this out to you, a reason for that is that people, one of the things the digital world arms us with is the ability to gauge who is reading or watching what. And one of the things you find in the print world is that many more people are interested in Kim Kardashian than they are in what's going on in Albany. And how do you deal with that? I mean, is it that a journalist is supposed to say, eat your spinach?
Well, wasn't that always our job,
no.
though? In part, is that I was telling Charlie, some of the interviews, I love Charlie, and I've been on his show, and I agree with you, the chance to finish a sentence is so rare in this business. And Charlie, you give such wide breadth to so many big thinkers and many voices. But when I think about the shows that I DVR of Charlie's, if I only have a couple hours, I'm going to go to the ones I think I'm least interested in because I know I'm going to learn the most there. Because I trust Charlie.
She told me this at lunch.
I trust Charlie to have on somebody that I'm going to learn from even if I think I'm not interested. And when did we? And I don't mean that as self-laudatory because I don't always do that. I still love The Sopranos, so I can't claim that I'm always watching
just high-class drama.
There you go. It's all the revenge I can't do. But the thing is, when did that, I would love to hear from young people on this. Do you still think that that is part of your job as a citizen in this country, not just as a journalist or a communications, but as a citizen, to make yourself learn about things you may not really have an initial interest in, but you know that part of being a citizen requires you to be better informed. And I think we're meeting the self-selecting crowd here. You know, I have never been to a university where so many reached out via Twitter and Facebook to welcome me before I got here. Thank you. That was such a warm welcome. But I do wonder, what about your peers? Your peers who are not here, are they as interested? I mean, what could we be doing? Because it sounds so arrogant, does it not? You should be interested in what we tell you you should be thinking about, even if you don't want to. And yet, who among us has not been wonderfully surprised, for example, walking through a bookstore and finding a book you didn't even know you were looking for?
Yeah.
How many of us even get the chance to do that anymore? Same with news shows. You tune in for one segment, you think, and then there's something else that changes your world. How often is that still happening?
But also, as part and parcel of this, is the incumbency on all of us who do have access to the levers of power and media to make it as interesting and as compelling and to write it as well and illustrate it as well as we can. And I find, you know, that sheer competence, the capacity to write a sentence, the capacity to be and to tell stories, you know, are the talents that we need to emphasize, and what we have now, because of the technology and because of the digital revolution, is a much easier way to tell stories.
But you could also make the argument, could you not, that technology and that digital revolution and that multiple choices that you get is actually a form of competition that forces you to be better.
Yes, indeed, absolutely.
But you also
look at the things that we really like. Most of the things we really like are really well done. You've mentioned The Good Wife.
Friday Night Lights.
I mean, these are high quality television programs that attract a big audience. I've always believed, and I know I'm naive, but I've always believed that all of us are attracted to smart comedy, things that's why we love Seinfeld. That's why we love
Jon Stewart.
That's why we love Stephen Colbert. That's why Stephen Colbert is going to CBS. I mean, these are people who, yes, they make you laugh.
You had to slip that in there, didn't you?
Charlie, he doesn't have a doctorate.
He doesn't. Colbert University. But I mean, I just think that it is, don't you agree with this? I mean, if you look at most of the programs that have done the best, it's because they are the best, in my judgment. I mean, it's not a case where the worst thing we could possibly produce is in the top 10.
And we're in the era of someone like Shonda Rhimes, who now owns an entire night of broadcast television.
Yeah. Thursday night.
On ABC.
Right.
She writes and produces all the shows. No, she has a writing staff, but she has created all those programs. She's a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. She's the Aaron Spelling of our time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the...
But he was number one with a lot of his shows, and they were really crap.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no question. But, I mean, he had the volume. He had the volume. But she's creating programming somehow, and I don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
I give maybe Ann Sweeney the credit, because she was running ABC at the time, that she saw something in China and gave China.
No, actually, it was line.
This is a bit like politics, too. I mean, if you think politics is so bad now in terms of how nasty it is, go back and look at Jefferson's campaign.
That's right. That's right.
Al, you were about to jump in and say
something. One of the things that I worry about is that we, with the people sending out tweets at 140 characters, that we lose the ability to not only produce longer form, but as you kind of mentioned, consume longer form. I mean, one of the things that it drives my kids crazy, but you know, they can't email thank you notes. They have to write a thank you note.
And that, you impose that upon them.
They're not happy about it, but they each have their own stationery and they have to write, and they have to write a letter. And it has
now, where is this? I'm misunderstood.
My kids.
Oh, your kids. You make them write.
I see. Write.
Yeah.
Are you going to make them write to Deborah to come to us?
I am going to make them.
Yeah.
And I worry about that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why, although I was very enamored with the Kindle and the iBook, I've kind of gone back to reading books. I mean, I physically bring a book with me on a plane because... I just like turning the page.
The thing that, Ken, you both are talking about and that touched me is that, I mean, I so much believe in human contact. I mean, Ken and I just riding up on this plane tonight because we hadn't seen each other a while across a dinner table, but hadn't really had this sort of wonderful conversation on the way up here. Two people sitting in a plane for an hour having a really wonderful conversation about a range of subjects, having to know what he's doing, what I do, people we know, the things we aspire to. I wonder, if you go to a restaurant now, you'll sit down and see people that are not talking to each other. They're looking at their smartphone.
Now, one of the things,
and what do we lose by that?
I addressed this earlier with some of you. I really worry when I see so many people with the buds in their ears, because so many of my column ideas, not to mention the richness of my life, is from the spontaneous interactions with strangers. And I never know when I'm going to have a conversation that can lead to something. For example, in 2004, one of the Pulitzer columns is about a tip jar that I saw at a coat check, and my husband and I were standing in line at a charitable event, and it was brimming with money. It was a big glass jar, and it said tips, and it had dollar bills, but fives and tens as well. And when I got up there, I noticed that it was all middle-aged women working part-time, waiting on all of us for dinner, and then one of them was working the coat check. And I noticed that she was tired, and I just made a flip little comment. Sherrod was standing behind me, and I said, I bet you're really looking forward to getting home tonight. And she said, I am so exhausted. And I pointed to the jar, and I said, well, at least you get to keep these. And she said, we don't keep the tips. And I said, what do you mean you don't keep the tips? Who keeps the tips? And she said, management keeps the tips. And I heard my husband, I said, what? And my husband behind me said, oh, no.
Here we go.
And as it turned out, I called management, and at first she was belligerent with me, saying, Connie, nobody cares who keeps the tips. I think they do. And in our business, you know you're onto something when you get 2 hours later a call on speakerphone from two company vice presidents that you didn't call. And you really know you're onto something when the first words out of one of their mouths is, Connie, there's no story here. So I gave them the opportunity to change their policy. They would not. They assured me that nobody cared who keeps the tips. And so I told the story basically as I told you in my column, and then I ended it with this. They said, you don't care who keeps the tips. I think they might be wrong. What do you think? They changed their policy by 11 o'clock that morning on the most popular radio show in Cleveland. And that was Readers. And I tell you that for two reasons. Every tip jar you see asks, because I guarantee you, you got a story coming. They do it everywhere. It's just unconscionable. But the other thing is, you never know when a simple conversation is going to lead to a moment, not just where you learn something, but that where you can change something. That is the value of that. And that's my pitch besides getting your flu shot. I heard so many of you haven't gotten your flu shot yet, so there you go. Yeah. Take the buds out, get the flu shot.
So if we have an auditorium with many students in it, many of whom are seniors, and many of them are communication majors. And if they came to each of you and they said, all right, what's your advice to me as to what I should do if I want to enter and become a journalist, be it on television or print, magazine or newspaper or online, whatever. What's your best advice to me as to what I should do? Al?
Well, I tell them that, first of all, if they're asking this when they're seniors, it may be too late, but that when they enter, they should be taking as many different classes as possible so they have as broad an education as possible. But that said, any job, and I think it is what we were told when we were coming out, that you take any job you can get, whatever it is, whether it's online, it's print, broadcast, radio, television, and see where you're going, because you probably don't even know what you really want to do, and that as you get into it and navigate, you'll find that way.
Dennis? I totally agree with that. I mean, find as much as you can and as early as you can, define what it is, find out what it is that you like the most, and also be willing to be alert and aware so that it can change if some factors and information and experience change it. Open yourself to experience, but the earlier you know where your passion is, find a way to be around people who do that. Because A, you will find a way to contribute more to that, and they will recognize what you can do. So as early as you can find that. But as we've said here, and I said in my remarks, come as well equipped as you can so that you can try to convince in some way I'm value added to your mission.
Dennis?
We talked about this in one of our classes earlier this afternoon. That was about the value, if you can afford to do it, if you can afford to take that summer off or a semester off, the internship. If you can get in an organization, if you can live in that organization, and once you're inside, to touch as many people as you possibly can. Because you'll find, whether you're in a local newspaper or a broadcast television station, a radio station, everyone will be generous with their time. If you're interested, if you want to do this for a living, you've got passion, people will sit down and tell you what it's all about and how to get from one place to the next.
But Connie, one of the things that's different about today, 20 years ago, you might have said to that senior, go work on the local TV station or local newspaper in out of state, small place, but those small places don't hire the way they once did. In fact, many of those newspapers are closed or online and with many fewer staff. TV doesn't have as many employees in the journalistic side. And so the question is, what do you tell that young male or female to do?
Well, I want to address your interior
and
life.
And interns, you don't have as many of those either.
Or those who can afford to do it for no pay.
Right.
That would have been, a kid like me could never have done that if I hadn't been paid. And I'm very mindful of the class inequities here. We're talking about the income inequities and who gets the advantages. It's the same with internships on the Hill. I want to address your interior life for a moment. And I said this in a class earlier. I think it's really important. Now is the perfect time to make a list of what you stand for. It's really important to know your own values, including your journalistic values. This is who I am. This is what matters to me. Because you're going to be challenged on that a lot, more so than I ever was when I got into this profession. I do think there are opportunities at smaller organizations, but not the number there used to be. But there's no such thing as a small job, and I don't mean that as a cliche. I don't care who I was writing for in the beginning. I could be filing a story for the Wilmette Gazette, but I told myself I was writing for the New York Times. That was my benchmark. And that was the standard that I set for myself. And I still think, with all the chaos going on in our profession right now, talent rises to the top. High standards rise to the top. The person you want to be is the headache the editor never has to have. You're the one who keeps your word. You're the one who makes it clear your standards, and you meet them regularly. You will stand out for that. It's ambitious. But ambition is a good thing, particularly when it's an ambition in a profession that I happen to think is still a calling.
Let's make this two-way. Let's start with questions. If you have any questions, just please line up. There's a microphone there. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Sabrina Savalls, and my question is open to all of you. Do you think that television networkers are going to be losing viewers to accessible social media outlets such as YouTube?
Ooh, I don't feel...
Will TV networks, cable or broadcast, be losing viewers to places like YouTube? Would you broaden YouTube to include Amazon or Netflix or no?
Yeah, overall.
I think there's an ebb and a flow. I think people are viewing the YouTube videos, things like that, Google, in chunks. But I think, to Charlie's point earlier, that you know, it's kind of like the cliche, if you build it, they will come. If you put on good television, How to Get Away with Murder or any of the Shonda Rhimes shows or The Good Wife or any, people are watching. And now they're just looking, they have more choices of where they can consume this quality. It used to be just three networks. Now it's three networks and HBO and Showtime and Netflix and Amazon. So there are a lot of different places to consume that. But if you make a good show, whether it's on a network or a streaming service, people are going to watch it. Yeah.
YouTube's changing, too. It's not what it used to be. I mean, it's not just cats anymore. I mean, they've got all kinds. Not like cats. It's not just that. It's become much more. They're tailored channels. I mean, so many people now, so many television programs have a YouTube channel.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hello, my name is Jordan McGee, and my question specifically to Charlie Rose. You know, obviously, you guys touched it briefly a little bit about social media, and you know, with your vast interviewing experience, has social media affected the way you prepare for interviews and/or evaluate your own interviews?
The answer to that is it has not, but it should. I think as much. I mean, I still am pretty much, you know, I'm known for and my bags under my eyes attest to the fact that I believe in preparation, because it's like a jazz musician. It gives you the capacity to dance. And the more you know, the more you can dance, or the more you can rip, or the more you can go and come back, and the more you can be spontaneous. So preparation is essential for me. I mean, I feel a bit, you know, I know that I can go in and do a conversation and ask questions like, what's your most challenging moment, and get interesting answers because I know I'd engage the people. You know, but it's so much more the more I know. And when I have not prepared as well as I want to, then I feel less good about the interview. And I, you know, almost every interview I do, I think of ways it could be better. If I can't, Ken will remind me. that's what friends are for. But at the same time, I think there are ways to use it. I mean, I tried to experiment with, when I have a big, big interview coming up, you know, try and use Quora, which I tried, and it hasn't quite been successful. But try to find a way through social media to say, I've got an interesting interview coming up. What is it you want to know? What are the questions you would like to ask? So that you use that vast audience out there as your own resource, you know. And I haven't quite figured out how to do it, and if somebody here can tell me, I will really appreciate it, because what I do now is what I've always done, but using online more, is just assemble as much information as I can. I have a producer or one or more does the same thing, but I always say to them, you know, tell me where your curiosity is, as I want to know where my curiosity is, because you can get locked in and be hostage to research. And then you will lose the spontaneity of somebody taking you to a place you haven't been before. But you start with knowing as much as you can, and then listening as much as you can, and being prepared to go where you don't know where the answers are. I mean, no great trial lawyer asks questions he doesn't know what the answers are. No great interviewer should limit himself to what he knows about the answer.
Thank you.
Next, please.
Hi, my name is Justine Polonsky, and my question is for Connie Schultz. Winning a Pulitzer Prize changed the way that you are as a journalist in any way?
It has not changed how I work as a journalist. It has definitely expanded my reach because I won it in Cleveland, Ohio. I count my blessings all the time for that, because it immediately enlarged my audience and it gave me more opportunities. But as I constantly remind people, the Pulitzer is a wonderful thing to win. I've had it now since 2005, and it has never hugged me and it has never told me it loved me. And the very next day I had a deadline, so on we go. Thanks for your question.
Hi, my name is Katie Rano, and this question is for Ken and Connie. So many of the traditional print papers are now cutting jobs and they are downsizing so that they can grow their digital platform and save money. With that being said, where do you see the future of print?
I mean, you know, you could argue half the glass is half full or half empty. I would argue both. I mean, I think in terms of, if you look at newspapers, clearly they're on a downward slope. You just look at the Syracuse Post Standard, 3 days a week, online, which is replicated in Ohio and
New Orleans
and lots of other places, not just Newhouse newspapers, but many others. And you look at an economic fact that's really important, which is one of the reasons why the gain in revenue from the digital doesn't match the loss in revenue from advertising in circulation. The average print ad in the New York Times it gets 10 times as much revenue as that same ad online. The reason for that is because the average reader of the New York Times spends 35 minutes a day reading the New York Times and spends 34 minutes a month reading the New York Times. So the advertiser knows that that reader is not going to be seeing those ads, so they pay that much less for it. And that's a real problem with print. And do I think the New York Times will always be in business? Yes. Maybe not with the same family owning it. And maybe someone doing what Murdoch is doing at the Journal, willing to lose money in order to keep that alive, and actually in many ways improve the Journal, surprisingly.
Yeah.
But I think the New Yorker will be alive, the Economist will be alive, good publications that do what Charlie does will stay alive. But I think many print publications will just die, including magazines.
What I've been watching closely, as many in our industry have been, is the Washington Post right now, because they are launching on quite the grand experiment. They've been doing a lot of hiring. We're going to see how this works. But I'm encouraged by some of the reporting that's been going on there. And I know a number of people there, so it's been fun to have those up-close conversations. Look, there's no question we're in trouble print-wise. I don't think that means necessarily ultimately we're in trouble as an industry. Your generation is, how many of you buy a newspaper even once a week? Okay, so...
Wow. So, yeah, very few hands went up.
Right, so that illustrates what our issue is. Some of it's generational. My generation is still buying and subscribing. We get three newspapers delivered to our... Well, three when the Plain Dealer's publishing, but we get the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times every day at our house in Cleveland. We're the only one on the street, the only house on the street who does. We're very aware of those sort of things. But I don't mean this. I don't mean this is all bad news. I'm really counting on you guys to figure this out.
But Ken, you know this. You know, if you talk to people like, and you have, and I don't want to misquote him, Arthur Sulzberg and people like that. I mean, they're saying it doesn't matter to us how you read it. We're agnostic about the delivery mechanism. You know, there's economic considerations in that. But over the long run, they're agnostic about the delivery mechanism. Yes?
Do you think that's true of them, really?
I don't.
I think it is because if you could do a newspaper electronically, a digital newspaper, what do you get rid of? You get rid of printing plus, the cost of printing.
Yeah.
You get rid of the cost of paper. You get rid of the cost of delivery, and so you save a lot of money.
Right.
The question is a business question, and can it work? Will if you move to a digital newspaper, will you get enough revenue to keep the newspaper alive?
And the question is, if it can work, how long will it take it to work?
Yes.
And what will happen between now and then?
Right now, you couldn't. I mean, the New York Times could not afford to jettison the print newspaper for a digital newspaper,
right,
because most of their income comes from the print newspaper.
Right.
Connie, what do you think about, like in New York, we have these AM Metro, you know, the newspapers.
The free newspapers.
Giving, free newspapers that they're just giving away. Yeah. I don't know if they have.
They're giving away, but they have advertising.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was just going to ask.
Yeah.
We don't see that in Cleveland. We're not having that. And I
really
have seen it in New York when I've driven. We've had a couple show up in D.C., I think, recently.
Yes.
But I'll tell you this. If it's totally advertised-driven, I don't trust the content. That's the problem. You know, I don't see it as an independent publication. Am I wrong about that? I mean, it seems like it's so heavily advertising-driven. I just don't count on the separation of church and state there.
You won't find any investigative reporting in those penny savers.
No. Right.
Mostly celebrity coverage, you know. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh,
question?
Right. Yeah. My name is Christopher Darr, and Mr. Roker, you said earlier that you started off reading the Kindle and then you found yourself going back to books. Do you find, this question's for all of you, do you think that our population as a whole will almost become bored eventually of technology because we continue to try to move forward with it? And at the same time, we keep coming out with newer and newer things, but some of it isn't really at the standard of, it's just not that good. So do you think that society might revert back to paper or just print?
Well, I think that there is, in a sense, maybe a little bit of a technology backlash, and that some people are, you go into different places and you see people buying physical books like Moleskine to be able to write diaries, and I think as you look at your world being hacked, whether it's pictures being stolen from the cloud or your credit cards, you know, nobody can really steal your thoughts if they've been written down and you have them in a drawer in your study or in your office. One of my prized possessions, it's kind of an anachronism, but I still have my Filofax from 1986, and I walk around with that.
And some people are going around buying up vinyl LP records.
Yes, yeah. So
because the sound is better.
It is.
I'm sorry I threw mine out.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I think the Kindle is really helpful at times. Like, as a columnist, you do a lot of reporting very quickly for a column, particularly if you're gonna do something on breaking news. And sometimes there's a book you remember you have somewhere in the thousands of books on your shelves, or you know a book. I can download it on Kindle within 90 seconds. I can do a search on it for a name or an issue, and I can find it like that. And then I can quote from the book. I really find that a valuable journalist tool. I like traveling with the Kindle because it's lighter than a book. But there's nothing like writing in the I'm big on marginalia. We were donating books. We moved. We downsized last year, and we gave away 700 books. We would have given more away, but we had so many handwritten notes in them. And we saw some of them go up on eBay anyway because we didn't catch them all, so that'll teach us. And I just think that it's a mix. But I have to say, one of the things I've noticed here today is how many of you wanted one-on-one moments for even a brief period of time. You wanted to have a conversation. You wanted to talk about what you're reading or what you've been interested in working on. And I find all of that encouraging because I'm not quite ready to say we've all surrendered to digital media and to technology and we're no longer interacting. And I do believe in that human longing that wants us to have that one-on-one contact. One of the most interesting questions I put up on Facebook about every 6 weeks is simply this: what's on your minds? And America unfolds. And I think it's such a timely reminder for journalists, because hundreds of people weigh in, and it's everything from the next episode of The Good Wife to they're outside of an emergency room waiting to see if their father's going to live. And it just unfolds, and you start to think about what you are competing with every time you're trying to get readers' or viewers' attention, what you're trying to do, because real life is unfolding every single day. And when I see those threads and I read them all the way through, David, I'm sure you've seen some of them on there, you cannot read those and not be moved. Sometimes I sit and I read them aloud to my husband, because I just want to remind him, Senator, that this is what the rest of America is talking about today.
Yes, question.
Hi, yes, thank you. My name is Sonny Goldbaum. My question is for Mr. Dennis Thatcher. Mr. Thatcher, how can today's digital revolution best be utilized by broadcast salespeople and station general managers?
Well, I think the great opportunity, and we need this opportunity, by the way, because the model has changed. Ken and I had a chance to talk before. He wrote this wonderful book called Three Blind Mice, just a fabulous book, and a kind of a broadcaster, old-time broadcaster like me, kind of the Bible. And that was an era where, networks paid local stations to carry network programming. And then that started to evolve where the pay got less and less, and then they started, the sports rights went crazy, and the networks came back to, can you pay a little bit for the sports because our rights fees are so high? Now all of our television stations, all of our big four affiliated television stations are now paying the networks for content. We're paying the networks for sports. The model has completely changed.
It used to be called compensation to the local station.
Well, now it's reverse compensation.
Wow. Right.
And then, a few years ago in the Communications Act, we had the opportunity to go to the cable companies, you remember this, and negotiate for retransmission consent, basically negotiate with the cable companies to carry our local television stations. Calm down, Lou. Calm down. Come on. I know he's going to get a little... Don't get too crazy here. So what a great boon to us, because as national advertising was slipping away and there was other competing media, certainly cable television in a big, big way, and the internet, we saw, wow, look at this bounty. We're going to get paid by the cable companies and the satellite companies to carry our broadcast television station. That's really our right to do, and Congress gave us that right.
But my impression, local television stations are doing quite well economically. Is that incorrect or correct?
Yours?
No, my impression. I'm just asking a question. Are local television stations doing well? Because when I read about the acquisition and I read about how it's a good business now. Is it a good business now?
Still a terrific business.
That's what I thought.
Profit margin yet.
Not the same margins, but still beats
But it used
the heck
to be at 80% when you go 80 60, down.
Yeah, yeah, it beats the heck out of being in the grocery business.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a 2-3% return. So anyway, so we started getting this money. I know this is not the total answer to your question, Sonny, but Sonny's such a bright guy. He'll hear it. And the network said, wow, that's great. You're getting paid. Give us that money, because they're giving you money for our program. So now they're taking it all back again. So we're looking to digital, and our company has invested a lot in digital as the next, as the next platform. We've got to follow the viewers, and where are the viewers? The viewers are migrating to tablets and smartphones. Our company and our partner company this year, combined with the digital companies that we own and the advertising sales, we'll do $50 million this year, and we're not a big company by any means.
This raises a question that Ken has covered too, and it used to be this great debate: is would you rather have content or distribution?
Well, that's been an ongoing argument: who's king?
Right.
And content, distribution. If you go to Silicon Valley, they would say technology is really king, and then you go to other places and they say, no, the real king is the consumer, which technology empowers them to be.
Right.
So to finish on the point, we support our television stations by community websites, not WXYZ website.com. They're all community-based websites. And we focus on the communities in these websites, and we direct our advertisers. And of course, we're a great, we have a great loudspeaker. We have newses, we have promos all day long. We have sometimes multiple channels with D2s and D3s, and we push them towards our website. And what we're doing now with those websites is we're not only selling our advertisers, commercial advertising on the air, spot advertising, but now we can direct them to that website. And now, gosh, here's a whole page to tell your story. Here's video to tell your story. Here's a place you could show all your used cars that you have for sale. So, you know, digital, Sunny, is a great opportunity for broadcasters. It enhances what we're doing.
Next question.
Hello, my name is Caleb Slater, and I've noticed that more and more newspapers and magazines are switching to online subscriptions where you get an issue every month in your email. And my question, which is an open question for everybody, is what are your thoughts on this change, and do you think that we'll reach a point where all magazine companies will just shift into the direction of email subscriptions?
You're the one covering them. What do you think?
No, I don't. Email, where you pay for, when you say email subscriptions, that email is the word that confuses me on that.
You have the subscription for the magazine. Say, for example, Sky Magazine is one that just did it, where you have the subscription, and instead of getting the magazine to your house, now you get it to your
email.
Yeah,
so a digital magazine.
Exactly.
Basically. Okay.
Exactly.
The question is the economics of it. It's really a business question. If the magazine can make money doing digitally, it beats losing money, you know, on with paper. But can they? That's the basic question. And one of the reasons is the digital revolution means that a lot of people can get that same information or pictures for free. And so therefore, what's your value added, to pick up a term Charlie used before, that will get them to subscribe, which they would have to do, to that magazine online? That's the basic question. It's the question that everyone in journalism, print, magazine, newspapers, is asking.
That's right.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Mike Cothran, and just a very brief shout-out specifically to Al Roker. My aunt, Joanne Scordato, graduated here the same year as you did, and she's always prided herself and in Oswego for like having that connection here. And when I mentioned that I was going to be a broadcasting major, her eyes lit up, and she immediately suggested here because she like second-handedly knew who you were. So through her, you were kind of my inspiration to get here. So hopefully she's watching, and she's probably like flipping out.
You hear what he just said? I
think we dated.
But my actual question is for all of you. The past couple of years, we've obviously seen Twitter explode and how it can be a platform both for, you know, like regular people and like professionals and actual, what am I trying to say, like jobs and stuff, and how like it can be this immediate place for people to go. But another app that recently came to fruition was Yik Yak, which I know some people here have heard about. And it's very similar in the style of Twitter, except it's only in your area and it's completely anonymous. And I've already seen, you know, stories about Oswego, but like here, like, oh, something happened in Shinnimon. So, and I've heard it through that before. I've heard it through other people. And it's even come down to like a person that goes on there and posts like weather for like the next day on there. And do you think that platform has the same chance of getting as popular as Twitter did, even if it is like an anonymity Twitter and only in your local area?
Do you think more young people are going to, because I know you're abandoning Facebook, right? Because we took, you're really mad we're on. And so is this a function, do you think, in part it's going to be the young persons, the younger generations?
Social? Absolutely. And I'm wondering,
because I could see that taking off for that reason alone, yeah. Because you're constantly trying to find ways that we can't find out what you're doing.
Anybody want to jump on that one?
I just think it needs a better name.
Yik Yak?
Yik Yak, yeah.
I got to find this out.
I'm sorry. They know now. I'm
That's
the one
so
that...
It's so embarrassing not to know something new.
I know nothing.
Well, on that yicky note, we're going to end. I want to thank our panelists. You're terrific.